It's also a good move in international politics, because when Yermak is not on the stage, it will be much, much easier to communicate.
A corruption scandal in Ukraine has forced a close ally of Volodymyr Zelensky to step down. For Friday, November 28th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead this hour, the latest on Pope Leo's first international trip. We'll also look at President Trump's military buildup in Latin America and what could come next as he and his administration try to pressure Venezuela.
I see this as a giant game of chicken.
And there's growing pressure for generational change in U.S. politics, but this might be taking it to an extreme.
You can ask my mom. I'm a natural-born leader, and I like helping other people.
We will talk to Nebraska's kid governor. Those stories and more coming up after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump says he's planning to cut off immigration from 19 poverty-stricken countries. His decision comes after two National Guard members were shot near the White House on Wednesday. NPR's Alana Wise reports the suspect has been identified as an Afghan national who is living in the United States.
Trump vowed on social media to, quote, permanently pause migration from all countries he deemed third world. He specifically accused Somali immigrants in Minnesota of preying on Minnesota natives and described the state's Governor Tim Walz with a slur against people with mental disabilities. The administration said people from 19 countries would face additional scrutiny. That includes people who hold green cards. Trump ran for office on a promise to stop crime, including illegal immigration. The two service members who were shot in D.C., one of whom has died, were in the nation's capital at the president's order to help curb crime in the city. Prior to their deployment, violent crime in D.C. had hit a 30-year low. Alana Wise, NPR News, Washington.
The White House says it's reviewing the vetting process for Afghan refugees who entered the U.S. under the Biden administration. Federal officials say the suspect in this week's shooting of two National Guard troops had previously served in a CIA-backed Afghan unit. Marine Corps veteran Elliot Ackerman says that unit required some of the most extensive screening.
Reporting says that he served there for about 10 years, and then he went through another round of vetting to come into this country. I think, you know, there's a worthy debate about the way some Afghans came to this country and the chaos around the withdrawal in 2021. But this case is not a case where there was insufficient vetting.
More than 75,000 Afghans came to the U.S. under a resettlement program in 2021. At least 128 people are dead after a massive fire in a public housing complex in Hong Kong. Reporter Cherise Pham says more arrests have been made in a corruption probe linked to the fire.
This is one of the deadliest fires in Hong Kong's history. It took more than 40 hours to extinguish. Government officials said temperatures on some floors were still too hot for rescuers to enter, warning that the death toll could climb even higher. The apartment complex had been under renovation, and police said construction material at the site was not up to standard. The fire alarms were also not working properly when the fire broke out, according to Hong Kong's Director of Fire Services. Officials have launched a corruption probe into the renovation project, leading to the arrest of 8 people on Friday. That's on top of 3 people from a construction company arrested on Thursday. For NPR News, I'm Cherise Pham in Hong Kong.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Today marks the 100th birthday of the Grand Ole Opry. The country music radio broadcast started in Nashville, Tennessee on November 28, 1925. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports it's still one of the longest-running radio broadcasts in U.S. history.
The Grand Ole Opry kicked off with an elderly fiddler named Uncle Jimmy Thompson, who recorded this a few years later. Over the years, the Grand Ole Opry would host powerhouse country performers, Patsy Cline, Loretta Lynn, and Hank Williams, who debuted on the fabled Ryman Auditorium stage. Johnny Cash met his wife June Carter there. Even after a move to the Grand Ole Opry House, it was a spiritual home to performers like Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys, performing there in 1985, the same year the Grand Ole Opry started broadcasting shows on PBS. It remains a central tourist attraction for Nashville, a city the Opry helped to place on the musical map. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Airbus is ordering an immediate software fix for thousands of its A320 series jets after a recent incident raised safety concerns. The company says strong solar radiation can corrupt data used by flight control systems. Industry sources say the recall will affect about 6,000 planes, more than half of the global fleet. Most will only need a short grounding to revert to earlier software, but some aircraft could require hardware changes, which may take weeks. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's 4:06. Good afternoon. It's All Things Considered here on People Powered, KAXC. Coming up, we are learning the latest on cuts to cancer research. Our thanks goes out to AW Research Laboratories in Brainerd, providing water testing for private wells, real estate, lakes, and wastewater since 1972. Online at awlab.com. Looking like a chance of flurries tonight, lows 10 to 15 degrees. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in.
Detro. Today in Ukraine, a top aide of President Volodymyr Zelensky resigned in a corruption probe. Andriy Yermak has often been described as the second most powerful man in the country after Zelensky. His resignation comes after anti-corruption officials raided his residence and office today. This comes at a deeply sensitive time for Zelensky and Ukrainian leadership as they're being pressured to work on a peace deal with Russia, brokered by officials in the Trump administration. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joins us now from the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. Hi, Eleanor.
Hello, Scott.
How did this all unfold?
Well, you know, this is fallout from an unfolding and very explosive corruption scandal that broke in mid-November about the siphoning off of at least $100 million tied to energy sector contracts and exposed by Ukraine's anti-corruption bureau. So far, eight officials, some close to Zelensky, are under investigation and two have fled the country. But more heads could roll. Zelensky himself is not implicated, but there are huge suspicions around his right-hand man, Andriy Yermak. And, Scott, this comes at such a sensitive time where Ukraine is negotiating its future with the Trump administration and Russia. You know, we saw the emergence of a very pro-Russian first draft of a peace deal proposal put out by the U.S., which shocked Ukraine and its European allies. It's been amended now after talks in Geneva this week. But it's a critical time for Ukraine, and this scandal is weakening Zelensky and his negotiating power and giving fodder to his enemies, of course, including the Kremlin. So we don't know if investigators found anything this morning at Yermak's apartment, but Zelensky clearly has had enough. In his daily video address on social media, he said he accepted Yermak's resignation. Let's listen.
І щоб внутрішня сила була, не має бути причин відволікатись на щось інше, крім...
So he said, for our internal strength, there should be no reason to be distracted by anything other than the defense of Ukraine. And he went on to say, Russia really wants Ukraine to make mistakes. We will make no mistakes.
So we know Yermak is powerful. We know that he's been a close ally of Zelensky. Tell us a little more about him and what role he's played in this wartime government.
Well, he's a former film producer. He goes way back with Zelensky, a business partner in Zelensky's TV days before being elected president of Ukraine in 2019. And he's really been Zelensky's right-hand man in office, and the two are close personal friends. They've basically lived in close quarters in the presidential compound behind the sandbags. They're said to even work out together, watch movies together to lower their stress. But over time, Yermak has amassed a lot of power. He basically ran the executive office. Everything went through him. And a majority of Ukrainians are happy about his resignation. I spoke with Alexander Krayev with a foreign policy think tank, and he says this shows that the anti-corruption authorities really are working independently. He says it's good for Ukraine domestically and internationally. Here he is.
It's a good move because, well, not only in internal politics, because yes, Yermak was mostly everybody despised him in internal politics. Everybody understood the level of his personal control over Zelensky. It is also a good move in international politics because when Yermak is not on the stage, it will be much, much easier to communicate.
Because, he says, officials in the Biden and Trump administrations and the Europeans, none of them liked Yermak.
So looking forward, who's going to be named in his place?
We don't know. Zelensky said this will be decided in the coming days, but these are crucial days. Yermak did have a lot of experience negotiating with the Trump administration, and he was expected to come to Florida in the coming days with Zelensky for peace talks with President Trump. So we'll see who replaces him.
That is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reporting for us in Kyiv. Eleanor, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
The ongoing battle between the Trump administration and top universities has many scientists asking whether they can continue their research, even research that could potentially be life-saving. From member station WBUR, reporter Martha Biebinger introduces us to one of those researchers, someone whose goal it is to prevent breast cancer.
Joan Brugge's lab at Harvard Medical School is all bright lights, sterile tubes, and sleek microscopes on metal counters. Walking through the lab, Brugge stops in front of about two dozen small plastic jars with pink lids. She lifts one with reverence. Each jar holds samples of breast tissue donated by patients who had a biopsy, a mastectomy, or other surgery like breast reduction.
We're going to section them and look at the architecture of the breast tissue.
Using the results, Brugge and colleagues have identified cells that contain the seeds for breast tumors. To Brugge's surprise, they are incredibly common.
Basically, every breast that we've looked at carries a small number of cells that have one or two of the mutations that are among those that are most commonly found in breast tumors.
So we're all walking around with the potential for tumors.
Exactly.
Brugge says her work could be a model for early cancer detection in other parts of our bodies. Now her team is looking for ways to isolate and eliminate those seed cells. She used to employ 18 researchers in this lab, but the Trump administration has upended funding for scientific research across the country and threatened ongoing research at Harvard in particular. Amid all of this disruption, Brugge lost a third of her staff, and the breast cancer research slowed way, way down.
We had to look at what we were originally planning on doing and look at the people that are left to do it and just basically had to cut back.
Brugge has found private funds to replace some lab members, but she says job candidates are wary because there is so much uncertainty about federal funding for cancer research. President Trump has proposed a 40% cut in the budget for the National Institutes of Health. In Congress, there's been pushback on those cuts, but there's still no final research budget for the current year. Mark Fleury with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network is reminding lawmakers why federal research funding matters. The cancer death rate, he says, is down 34% since the early 90s.
But we still have an incredible ways to go before, you know, we can say we've really changed the trajectory of cancer.
At least two reports have found that cutting grants like Brugge's would mean fewer drugs to treat cancer and other diseases. One of those reports was co-authored by MIT professor Pierre Azoulay. It shows nearly 60% of drugs approved by the FDA since 2000 used research funded by the National Institutes of Health.
We can't say, but for that grant, that drug wouldn't have come into existence. But it makes us at least want to pause and say, okay, what are we doing here? Are we shooting ourselves in the foot?
Instead of research, Brugge spends at least half of her time these days searching for funding, managing employees' anxieties, and trying to plan ahead when the news keeps changing. She worries work in her lab will never return to normal.
There'll always be now this existential threat to research, and I will definitely be concerned because we don't know what's going to happen in the future that might trigger a similar kind of action.
Brugge has thought about winding down the work and closing the lab, but she still sees so much promise in those pink-lidded jars. For NPR News, I'm Martha Biebinger in Boston.
That story comes from NPR's partnership with WBUR and KFF Health News. If you have ever lived with a cat, you might be familiar with the phrase or the feeling that nobody really owns a cat, they own you. Perhaps that is because scientists consider household cats to only be semi-domesticated animals, which, as anybody who's lived with a dog knows, is unlike dogs. NPR's Nate Rott reports on a new study aimed at finding when this, let's call it delicate, relationship began.
Claudio Ottoni and Marco De Martino are researchers at the University of Rome Tor Vergata. Both focus on paleobiology, the study of ancient life. In this case, ancient cats. So?
I'm assuming you guys are both cat people? Yes.
Me neither.
There was a little hesitation there is a little hesitation.
No, I mean, I'm really fascinated by the animal.
This is Ohtone.
I have studied cats now, the genetics, for like 15 years.
So he gets asked that question a lot. And his typical answer is...
Actually, not really. I like studying animal domestication. And cats are fascinating. Maybe I will get a cat for my daughter soon. I don't know. I'm still hesitating.
Cats are fascinating, Ohtone says, because the history of their domestication, when it happened and where, is less understood than the domestication of other animals like pigs, sheep, horses, or dogs. In part because domestic cat and wild cat skeletons look almost identical. And because archaeological evidence shows humans and cats were interacting long before domestication happened. Which DeMartino says makes sense when you think about how those first intensive interactions would have occurred.
Cats were attracted to food storage containing grains and other goods. This in turn attracted mice, which were a natural prey.
So humans attracted mice, mice attracted cats, and somehow, somewhere, the relationship evolved. The new study published in the journal Science, which looked at ancient DNA, suggests the shift happened in North Africa a few thousand years ago. Ohtone says maybe in Egypt.
Egypt would be like the key place because of all the iconography we have.
Iconography like the cat-headed goddess Bastet. What was more surprising, though, DeMartino says, is their research found...
The earliest domestic genomes arrived in Europe roughly around 2,000 years ago, several millennia later than previously thought.
In other words, in just 2,000 years, domestic cats went from being geographically isolated to pets all around the world. Jonathan Lassus, an evolutionary biologist at Washington University in St. Louis, says the new study helps us understand more about evolution and animal domestication, which could have applications today. For example, he says,
raccoons, opossums, foxes, they're all in some sense doing the same thing that cats and dogs did, that is adapting to be around us, but they're clearly not what we'd call domesticated.
What would it take for that to change? Would we want it to change? Lassus doesn't have answers for either, but he says this research helps us better understand our ongoing relationship with nature. And he adds,
people love cats,
even if cats don't always love us. Nate Rott, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
#4:18 coming up, it is John Latimer. It's our daily dose of nature, and you can catch our latest season watch podcast. You can hear it on the air tomorrow at 1:30, Sundays at 10:30, or sign up through Apple, Spotify, or more. This week, Charlie Mitchell telling us the story of trying to save a fledgling owl. We are looking at possible flurries for tonight and temperatures from 10 to 15.
On today's date, November 28th, 1999, the Bohemian Waxwings have once again returned to northern Minnesota. They'll be regular visitors throughout the winter, wherever they can find a tree with some fruit left on it. They come in big flocks, and they never seem to stay in an area very long. Once they've exhausted the fruit of the trees, they will move on to the next spot, next town maybe. But they are certainly vagabonds in their own way and style. One of the interesting features about Bohemian waxwings is that as they fly in a flock together, they will circle about a tree preparatory to landing and come to the tree into the wind. They always land facing into the wind. So if you happen to be watching a flock of waxwings and they spin about a big tree, maybe where they're going to stop and rest, and as they come into the tree, if you note the direction that they're flying, that will tell you which direction the wind is blowing.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more, MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. The U.S. military buildup in the Southern Caribbean is fueling expectations of a strike on Venezuela. Washington has now blacklisted its government as a foreign terrorist organization. But a U.S. intervention on Venezuelan soil would be unpopular among Americans and could backfire. John Otis reports in a warning that this story does contain the sound of gunfire.
Ever since his first term, President Trump has pushed for regime change in Venezuela. Its president, Nicolas Maduro, has crushed Venezuela's democracy and led the country into economic misery, prompting some 8 million Venezuelans to flee the country. U.S. officials claim Maduro and his top military brass are terrorist drug traffickers, a designation the Venezuelan government denies. Meanwhile, Trump has dispatched the largest U.S. naval flotilla to the Caribbean since the Cuban Missile Crisis. In Venezuela, anti-government influencers are promoting AI-generated videos fantasizing about a U.S. intervention. This one shows Maduro in an orange prison jumpsuit in the custody of American officials, with narration that says, "All Venezuelans want this as our Christmas present." The most extreme option would be a U.S. invasion. But the 15,000 U.S. military personnel currently stationed in the Caribbean would not be enough to take over Venezuela. The South American country is larger than Texas and is home to rugged mountains and the Amazon rainforest. Should the U.S. put together a more robust invasion force, it could quickly subdue Venezuela's army. Indeed, many of its poorly paid rank-and-file soldiers might switch sides. But there would be substantial pushback from unconventional forces, says Jeremy McDermott, co-director of Insight Crime, which analyzes organized crime in Latin America.
You put boots on the ground almost anywhere in Venezuela, and you are going to face armed resistance.
That resistance would include pro-Maduro militias known as colectivos, as well as Colombian guerrillas based inside Venezuela.
What Venezuela does have is at least 1,000 battle-hardened Colombian guerrillas. They are a pro-regime paramilitary force.
In addition, the Maduro government has been handing out weapons to civilians. This report on state TV shows them taking target practice under the guidance of military trainers. One of the trainers says, "This is a people's war to defend our country." Yet most Venezuelans despise Maduro and voted against him in last year's presidential election that was considered by many, including the U.S., to have been stolen by his regime.
¿Qué peso tiene Maduro en la sociedad estadounidense? Nada, nada.
Do Americans really care about Maduro? Asks Venezuelan opposition congressman Enrique Capriles. He answers, not at all. Trump may be betting that his military buildup will create a pressure cooker in Caracas that will provoke a palace coup. But that's a long shot, as Maduro is surrounded by loyal officers and Cuban bodyguards. Even if he were toppled, there's no guarantee the new leader would forge a stable democratic government. What's more, Trump is famously no fan of nation building.
¿Cuál es el day after? ¿Está dispuesto los Estados Unidos a poner 100 mil millones de dólares para estabilizar económicamente y socialmente Venezuela?
What about the day after a coup, Capriles says? Is the U.S. willing to spend $100 billion to help stabilize Venezuela? Officially, what's being called Operation Southern Spear is an anti-narcotics mission with U.S. forces blowing up alleged drug boats in the Caribbean. But Venezuelan political analyst Benigno Alarcón says that's not much to show for such a massive military buildup.
Yo creo que Estados Unidos no puede justificar que la operación fue un éxito porque hundió.
It will be embarrassing for the U.S. if it fails to force political change in Venezuela, Alarcón says. He adds, I don't think they can call this operation operation a success if all they do is sink 10 boats and kill 80 drug traffickers.
I see this as a giant game of chicken.
That's McDermott of Insight Crime.
Because Maduro knows if he can hang on, President Trump can't keep whatever it is, 11% or more of the U.S. fleet indefinitely off the coasts of Venezuela. So long as he doesn't blink, time is on his side.
For NPR News, I'm John Otis.
We talk to a lot of politicians on this show. So when Nebraska elected its newest official in a special election earlier this month, we reached out.
You can ask my mom. I'm a natural born leader and I like helping other people.
That's 10-year-old Charlie Couch, Nebraska's first ever kid governor. She won the state's top spot after 600 of her fellow fifth graders voted her in.
This victory is not just mine. It belongs to every fifth grader in Nebraska who wants to make a real difference in our state.
Five other states have kid governor programs. The goal is to teach kids how elections work by holding actual elections. Kid governors serve a year-long term. They focus on one issue they're passionate about. Couch ran on a platform of cancer awareness. Every candidate needs to provide a three-point plan. Couch has hers memorized.
Number one, we can hold fundraisers and activities to raise money not only for treatment, but also so that we can help financially with organizations like Camp Kesem. Two, I can meet with doctors, nurses, and patient families.
The program's first ever kid governor is now a 20-year-old senior at the University of Connecticut. Alana Tipton says that megaphone to talk about one issue is one of the reasons the program is so special.
My advice to her would be your dreams can never be too big and that she can accomplish anything she puts her mind to.
As for Charlie Couch, she says she's most excited about two things going into her term.
Just helping people and making sure people know that no matter what, they are loved and they are safe.
It seems like we've been talking about artificial intelligence nonstop. College students using it to write papers, people using it to plan trips, AI-generated musicians, it goes on and on. But could this powerful technology upend traditional American politics? How data scientists are harnessing AI to influence their decisions and how partisan strategists are using it to gain a political edge. You can listen for that story on Monday's All Things Considered. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Coming up next on KEXE, we bring you National Native News. I'm Heidi Holton. It's 4:29. We're learning about how hundreds of evacuees from Western Alaska are staying in Anchorage hotels after last month's storms destroyed their homes. Our thanks goes out to Rapids Brewing Company for their support. They're a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. And thanks also to the Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji. They have exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists. Found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. Watermark Art Center. www.ecosystemsnow.org. Going to see some flurries for tonight, and then temperatures 10 to 15, slight chance of snow tomorrow, 22 degrees for the average. No evening lows tomorrow, 3 to 8, but by Sunday night, we're looking at 1 below to 5 below.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A month after the devastating Western Alaska storm, hundreds of evacuees are still sheltering in hotels in Anchorage. This week, some received a delivery of subsistence food donations, a small taste of home during the holiday season. Ayolna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has this story.
Stephanie Anover answers the door to her hotel room. A volunteer hands her a bag filled with traditional foods.
Oh, it's fish, salmon, and some strips.
Anover was living in Kipnik when the remnants of Typhoon Halon destroyed her home. She's one of more than 600 displaced people staying in Anchorage hotels. The storm also devastated traditional harvests.
Left us with nothing.
Anover says she's thankful to receive the subsistence food donations.
It's good to have a native food subsistence to share with my family. Yes, yes.
Alaska Native Heritage Center and other local organizations have been gathering subsistence food donations for over a month, and they have been distributing them to evacuees. Veronica Berger is a program manager at the Heritage Center. She says they have delivered to about 250 rooms in hotels across Anchorage.
They lost a lot of their harvests, their gatherings, so it's helped get a little taste of home.
Berger says the Heritage Center staff try to be mindful of the conditions people have in hotels and deliver food that they can actually use. She says they have two types of donation bags. The one for hotels with kitchens includes items like fish fillets and moose meat cuts. And evacuees who don't have kitchens receive a bag with items they don't have to cook, like muktuk and herring eggs.
Anything that they can eat raw, I guess.
For Elizabeth Smith from Kipnik, the most exciting item in the food bag was
herring eggs, but I need oil.
Smith says she usually adds seal oil to herring eggs, so she wishes the donation bag included that. For now, she says she will keep the food donations in her mini fridge.
My family is over at the Aspen. I might go see them. I might share them this.
In addition to delivering food to hotels, the Heritage Center also hosted potlucks and is planning more events in the months to come. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
A new report highlights the high levels of childhood trauma among juveniles who are tried as adults. Juvenile justice advocates are seeking reforms that consider these experiences before, during, and after interactions with the court system. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
The research from Human Rights for Kids show of the more than 2,200 incarcerated people surveyed, greater than 80% experienced four or more adverse childhood experiences, a rate far higher than the general population. In a recent webinar, report co-author Aiden Leslie explained many respondents endured severe abuse beginning around age six, had been trafficked or exploited, or had committed offenses linked directly to their abuse. He says almost none had their trauma taken into account by judges during their sentencing.
Once children end up in the adult justice system, they face a level of repression and victimization that only serves to compound the trauma they've already experienced, while failing to actually address that trauma. The justice system itself also tends to serve as an extremely intimidating and traumatic experience.
Leslie says some of the profound developmental impacts of trauma include higher rates of mental health conditions among youth in the system, with especially severe experiences for girls and Native American children. I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP, whose Family Caregiver Resource Guide is available to caregivers by calling 877-333-5885 or at aarp.org/caregiver resources. Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Separation of church and state. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And from The Economist, in a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise, to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, and videos at economist.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Pope Leo XIV is making the first foreign trip of his papacy. Today in Turkey, he visited a site where 1,700 years ago, early Christian leaders met in a council and agreed on a creed still spoken in churches today. NPR's Ruth Sherlock is traveling with the first American pope and witnessed the ceremony.
Sing praises, all you people.
At the shoreline of Lake Iznik, with rolling hills shrouded in mist on either side, Catholic Pope Leo XIV and the spiritual leader of the Orthodox Christians, Patriarch Bartholomew, stood side by side at the site where a foundational statement of Christian faith was born.
We believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty.
The Nicene Creed.
Of heaven and earth, of all that is seen and unseen.
It was here that in the year 325, bishops came from across the Roman Empire to try to solve a division that was threatening to destroy the church. An Alexandrian priest, Arius, argued that Jesus was the highest created being, but not equal to God. Emperor Constantine, who wanted to unite the church to strengthen his empire, called on the bishops to journey to this site close to modern-day Iznik to settle the doctrinal argument. The First Council of Nicaea soundly rejected Arius' teachings and laid the foundation for the Nicene Creed. Despite schisms and divisions within the church over the centuries, this creed continues to be used by many denominations today.
The power of this place does not reside in what passes away, but in what endures forever.
Orthodox Patriarch Bartholomew at the ceremony spoke of the importance of returning to this unifying event in Christian history.
We return to this wellspring of the Christian faith in order to move forward. We refresh ourselves at these inspired waters of rest in order to become strong for the tasks that lie ahead.
Pope Leo used this anniversary of the First Council of Nicaea to call for unity among Christians, but also among other faiths and communities.
We must strongly reject the use of religion for justifying war, violence, or any form of fundamentalism or fanaticism.
It's a call to peace that has become his core message in this first papal voyage, warning that fomenting divisions in societies around the world are placing the very future of humanity at stake. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Iznik, Turkey.
Today on the biggest shopping day of the year, many experts are watching how we spend. They're watching very closely and looking for clues about the economy and prices through the holidays and into the future. NPR's retail correspondent, Alina Selyuk, spent a day with one of those experts.
I meet Katie Thomas in our shared natural habitat.
When I think of a mall, this is my tried and true.
The mall, this one in Pittsburgh, where Thomas lives.
When I was in high school, I worked at this Macy's.
And this Macy's is still here, so is the old JCPenney, but now there are also all the trendy stores like Aritzia and a row of luxury brands like Burberry. And Thomas, she's shopped this mall, she's worked it, and now she studies it. The displays, the visitors, the bags they carry.
These four guys walking by, they all are like high school age, and they all have a bunch of bags, just, you know, friends shopping together.
On a Thursday afternoon.
Exactly, after school.
Malls are not dead.
No, they're not.
Thomas leads the Kearney Consumer Institute. It's a think tank that's part of a consulting firm used by some of the biggest companies you know. And her job is to make sense of our messy consumer economy, trying to peel back what it is that our shopping habits tell us about our future. You're like a retail fortune teller.
That's what I try to be. I try to get ahead of the curve, you know.
Inside her crystal ball is a muddle of data from the government, from companies and surveys, plus her own conversations with workers and shoppers, like Shay Harmison, who is visiting from West Virginia.
Are you shopping today just for fun, holiday shopping?
I bought some things for myself and Christmas stuff today. I bought some jeans and a top from Madewell. I bought a leather pleather jacket, a shirt from J. Crew, and my daughter a pair of sunglasses.
And Thomas connects these many dots into all kinds of insights. Here's a fun one about minimalism. The pandemic had us cocooning in neutrals and comfy cozies. The millennial obsession with beige, grays, and pastels. But now color is roaring back and maximalism, bold prints and plushies dangling on purses.
We want to be loud. We want to be individuals. We want to feel seen. I've even heard from employees in this mall, people are spending on the wow piece, not the basic, something fun.
The splurge on the wow piece can seem hard to fit into what we hear a lot lately about spending, that consumers are anxious, cautious, tightening their budgets. And this is the nuance that Thomas thinks about a lot.
I think we often miss the psychological piece of it, and that's what it is. It's not just where are consumers spending their dollars, it's the why and the how.
The how is the wages shoppers still have. Our budgets feel fragile, but generally speaking, people are employed. And the why right now is a special season.
People like the holidays. They want to celebrate with their friends and family. They want to get a good deal. They're going to be thoughtful, but they're going to spend.
This has many forecasters predicting another record holiday season. The National Retail Federation, the industry trade group, says holiday sales will break $1 trillion. Growing similarly to last year. Thomas thinks maybe not quite that much, and that growth will likely be followed by a hangover.
2026 is going to hit, and we're going to see a reset.
As she studies us, the shoppers, she's already seeing the signs of this.
I'm calling it the frugal consumer. Now, I don't mean frugal in a super traditional way, penny pinching. I still find my grandma's tinfoil in the attic. But I mean, we're seeing exhaustion that extends far beyond the wallet.
Not just money, but time and energy spent worrying about tariffs, inflation, uncertainty. Retailers have called this mood many different things, like shoppers being selective, mindful, choiceful. Thomas thinks there's a deeper truth to it.
I think consumers, what it actually all goes back to is control. They're trying to figure out what they can control in a world where they feel a sheer loss of control.
The way Thomas is seeing this show up is more people second-guessing, doing a quicker gut check on that one extra thing. Like, do I really want it? In fact, remember that shopper from West Virginia, Shay Harmison? She says almost exactly this when she thinks about how her holiday spending might be different this year.
I'll probably just try not to buy as much nonsense stuff.
Just as Thomas was saying.
Socks, I don't know, just jewelry, just stuff to buy, you know, like not spending money on things that I don't think are going to be useful or they might not use.
And Thomas predicts, for some news you can use, this means stores may have to give shoppers deeper discounts than they'd anticipated this holiday season, just to shake our urge for control a bit more loose. Alina Selyukh, NPR News, Pittsburgh.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:44. You're tuned into People Powered KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. We've got voices from where we live. That's North Star Stories coming up next. We're learning about targeting online gambling sites in the state of Minnesota. Looking at a cloudy night tonight, chance of flurries with lows 10 to 15, and a slight chance of snow tomorrow, mostly cloudy with highs near 22 degrees. We would like to thank the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com, member FDIC. We also received support this afternoon from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure with 13 locations across the Northland. More at LMSupply.com. So many things going on. The Night We Light Parade is in Bemidji and the 44th annual City of Lights event in downtown Nisswa.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota.
Minnesota targets illegal online gambling sites. Then, a growing disease has hunters and officials looking for solutions. And important information for Minnesotans who don't have medical insurance through their employer. I'm Chantel Sings. Minnesota's Attorney General is shutting down 14 gambling websites. The sites include social sweepstakes, casinos, and platforms offering sports betting, poker, and other online gambling. The Attorney General's office says the website may be violating Minnesota's consumer protection and wagering laws. State officials say unregulated gambling sites offer no consumer protections, and people using the websites within the state have no guarantees that winnings will be paid out or that games are fair. In today's main story, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and tribal partners are strategizing ways to address chronic wasting disease, a growing concern for Minnesota's deer hunters. Maya Hecht has the story.
Deer hunting is a rite of passage or traditional life way for many Minnesotans. The recent emergence of chronic wasting disease, or CWD, is changing the way many hunt in the North Woods.
Yeah, when I first started out working for the band about 7 years ago, I always thought we had probably a decade plus before we'd even have to worry about CWD being up in northern Minnesota.
Tanya Rourke is the Wildlife Program Director for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe's Resource Management Division.
Then all of a sudden, when there was the Cervid Farm northwest of Bemidji, it became a very real concern for us.
A cervid farm is a facility that raises deer, elk, or moose as livestock.
Chronic wasting disease, or CWD, it's a neurologic disease of the cervid family.
Eric Hildebrand is the wildlife health supervisor with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, which has implemented statewide testing to prevent the spread of CWD and help hunters avoid consuming meat from infected animals.
So in Minnesota, we are on the front end of an infection, meaning that when a hunter harvests a deer and if it tests positive for CWD, it is a presumably healthy-looking animal.
Although the disease is not known to infect humans, officials say you shouldn't eat infected venison.
The incubation period of the disease is 1.5 to 3 years before clinical signs set in. And clinical signs being emaciation, incoordination, drooling, stumbling, and unafraid of people.
For hunters who would like to test their deer, Eric says there are a few options.
On the DNR website, on the CW page, we have hunter mailing kits that a hunter can simply go to the website, log their information, and we will ship a kit directly to them. All the instructions and a prepaid shipping label are all provided.
For testing, hunters need to save neurologic tissue, such as the deer's head or lymph nodes, which can be frozen prior to testing. If hunters would rather not deal with the mail,
they could contact any DNR wildlife office across the state and set up a time to meet with the staff there and get the sample pulled from their harvest.
This year, over 7,000 deer have been tested across Minnesota in collaboration with 5 of the 11 tribal nations that share its geography. Tanya Rourke says,
a large part of that success was because of all the tribes coming together and starting up this tribal CWD network.
A major focus of that network is proper disposal, because CWD prions, the molecular protein that causes illness, remain infectious in soil even after a deer decomposes.
It is hard when you're used to putting the animal back to the environment. You want to give that back to nature. It's a big risk to do that when you're dealing with CWD.
Instead, DNR and tribal nations are providing dumpsters for infected carcasses. Statewide testing and disposal locations are available online at the DNR's website. Maya Hecht for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. MinSure, the official health insurance marketplace for Minnesota, has officially opened enrollment for 2026 health insurance, giving Minnesotans without employer coverage a chance to compare plans and access financial help. Farmers, small business owners, early retirees, and others can use MinSure to estimate costs and see if they qualify for tax credits. Coverage starting January 1, 2026 requires enrollment by December 15th, while coverage beginning February 1st must be selected by January 15th, 2026. Minnesotans can get applications and enrollment help from health insurance experts at no cost at the MinSure website.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
It's 83 years since the deadliest nightclub fire in U.S. history. The Coconut Grove nightclub fire killed nearly 500 people and injured hundreds more in Boston. It changed safety codes and burn care forever. From member station WBUR, Amanda Beeland spoke with two people who lost family members in the blaze.
On the weekend after Thanksgiving in 1942, Ina Faye Cutler was glued to her radio. The 13-year-old was waiting to hear news about her mother, Jeanette Zahl.
You held your breath to hear your mother's name at a hospital. And it was such a shock.
The 35-year-old Zahl had tagged along with a group of people to the Coconut Grove nightclub, an it spot in Boston at the time.
The war news is shared here at home with a terrible tragedy in Boston. Fire swept through the Coconut Grove, a nightclub in the hub city last night.
Zahl and her sister were among those killed. Ina Faye Cutler says her mom had never been to a nightclub before.
I just felt such sorrow. Such sorrow. Why was she there? And had we gone on Thanksgiving, she wouldn't have been there. And as a child, it's hard to put that together. I mean, it's serendipitous. It's just something that never, never should have happened.
Cutler's mother and aunt were among the more than 1,000 people of all ages believed to be there that night. The club was licensed to serve half that number. The multi-level building was decorated with fake palm trees and fabric, all flammable. It's not officially known how the fire started, but reports say in less than 15 minutes, the building was consumed by it. Frantic patrons tried to get out, but the majority of the club's doors were locked. The club, once a party, became a nightmare.
I still remember wondering, why are the fire engines going by?
Peter Coffey, then of Watertown, Massachusetts, was 5 years old when his older cousin Mary Ellen McCormick was killed in the fire.
I remember my father coming home, white-faced, and saying to my mother, "We found her."
Maymay, as the family called her, is thought to have died at one of the club's doors. To memorialize her, Coffey's family named his sister Mary Ellen.
I really think in some ways Maymay would like that.
The Coconut Grove fire was horrific, but it sparked change, like new treatments for burns and updates for fire and building codes around the country. For example, a revolving door can't be the only or primary exit without an adjacent door that opens out. For Ina Faye Cutler, the Coconut Grove nightclub fire changed her life forever. The loss of her mom stole a lot of her childhood. Cutler was the oldest of her siblings, so she had to help run her father's candy and tobacco shop.
Frankly, a lot of responsibility did fall on me because there was no one else.
Even though the Coconut Grove nightclub fire was a long time ago, Cutler wants future generations to remember it.
How could you not keep that a sacred place? How could you not commemorate almost 500 people's deaths?
A permanent memorial is under construction with support from the city of Boston. It's set to be dedicated next spring. It will feature three archways, just like the Coconut Grove nightclub had. Visitors will be able to walk around the arches and read the names of those who died. For NPR News, I'm Amanda Beeland in Boston.
One of the most talked about films on the festival circuit this fall has been Hamnet, based on a 2020 novel about William Shakespeare. The thing that's being talked about is how many moviegoers, even hardened critics, leave the film sobbing. And NPR's Bob Mondello admits that he was one of them.
I certainly didn't start out that way. The opening images are of a woman in scarlet curled up among tree roots in a forest near Stratford. It's the 1580s, and Anya's, as she's known, is awaiting the return of a hawk. When she spots it on a branch and signals, it flies to her arm. Anya's, played by Jesse Buckley, has the same effect on Will, a young Latin tutor played by Paul Mescal. One look out the window at her and her hawk, and Will's abandoned his students and proves thoroughly tongue-tied in her presence, though she knows how to open him up.
Tell me a story.
What story would you like?
Something that moves you.
That he can do. It'll be a whirlwind courtship. She takes his hand at one point and looks into his eyes.
What are you doing?
He's learned by this time that folks in town think her mother was a witch. She certainly bewitched him.
Is it true? You know everything about a person by touching them here?
Not everything.
What did you see?
I saw a landscape.
Saw a landscape?
Mm-hmm. Spaces. Caves. Tunnels and oceans. Undiscovered countries.
If he wasn't in love before, that does it. He says he wants to be handfasted now.
I have no talent for waiting.
Nobody approves. Doesn't matter. They've soon got a daughter, then adorable twins who grow and play act, pretending to be witches.
When shall we three meet again?
Yes, three witches, like in one of the early plays Will started writing for an acting troupe in London. They are happy, this family, though young Hamnet does miss his father when he's away.
Will we go with you this time?
No, not yet. I need you to look after your mother and your sisters. Will you do that?
Yes.
Will you be brave?
Yes.
Yes. Will you be brave?
Yes.
Will you be brave?
Yes! Ah! Yes, I'll be brave!
Based on Maggie O'Farrell's novel, Chloe Zhao's film luxuriates in the joy of these early scenes.
Bye.
Painting the family and the natural world in rich, earthy tones before bringing that world crashing down around them. Will is in London when tragedy strikes, so Buckley's anguished Anya's faces the death of their 11-year-old son alone.
Mama!
My boy!
And can't forgive Will for not being there. Buckley makes Anya's grief so all-encompassing that she can barely register that Will also grieves as he rushes back to a play in London bearing their son's name to try to get his actors to hold, as twere, the mirror up to nature.
I am myself indifferent.
I am myself indifferent on it again.
I think it's in this moment that the film shifts from being a portrait of a family tragedy to become a tale, an instance almost, of the transcendent healing power of art. It takes directorial sleight of hand and historical fudging to make it all work. But work it does in a knockout theatrical climax. Anya's reaching for a son who is no more. Will bringing forth a play that will never die.
To die. To sleep. Perchance to dream.
That magic the theater is supposed to perform is here performed. If there's been a more staggering cinematic catharsis in recent years, I've not experienced it. I'm Bob Mundell.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Focus Features presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. From Total Wine & More, where people can find wines, spirits, and beers for holiday gatherings at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
Another hour ahead of All Things Considered, followed by the news from Canada, It's As It Happens. Diane Ott is our volunteer host for On the River that begins tonight at 7 o'clock. This is 91.7 KEXE Grand Rapids, Aiken, Hibbing in Virginia, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, Park Rapids and Fauston, 89.9 Brainerd, Nisswa and Merrifield, and on your smart speaker, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Support comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at AtchisonTire.com. Weather around the region, some more flurries for tonight. Lows 10 to 15 degrees, and tomorrow, slight chance of snow, mostly cloudy. Highs near 22 degrees. More news is next. It's 5 o'clock.